physics has shown us that doing mathematical analyses on simple models is a very, very fruitful game. And I strongly felt and continue to believe that it's a fruitful game to play in neuroscience as well. The perspective is that somehow you have modules, you know, subnetworks in the brain that do things, right? And you wanna understand how they can be embedded in a larger network so that say they can still do their thing and not be kind of destroyed in terms of the activity they produce by the way that they're embedded. Neural networks fundamentally are high-dimensional nonlinear dynamical systems. And high-dimensional nonlinear dynamical systems are a nightmare mathematically. It's really hard.
This is Brain Inspired.
Hey everyone, it's Paul. Often on this podcast, we talk about how deep learning models might be used to help explain our brain processes and intelligence. But a continuing obstacle is that we're using one complex system to study another. We don't yet have a great grasp on how artificial neural networks are doing their thing, so it's an ongoing question how we'll use them to explain how wet neural networks, our brains, do their thing. Karina Curto is a neurotheoretical mathematician at Penn State University. I just made that phrase up, but what I mean is that she applies her background skills in mathematical physics to study theoretical neuroscience. One of the mathematical tools she uses is topology, which in neuroscience is roughly the study of the theoretical geometric shapes we use to say something about the possible range of activity of a population of neurons. So we've discussed the dynamical systems approach multiple times on the podcast, things like how neural population activity can often be reduced in dimension and traced out over time on some lower dimensional structure, like a manifold or a tractor. And that manifold is a way to think about the shape of cognition, so to speak. Topology is the study of those possible manifold-like structures and the rules by which neural activity is allowed to unfold. It's a pretty new tool in neuroscience, so we discuss it during this episode. Another mathematical tool Karina uses are called linear threshold networks, and in her case, often a special case called combinatorial linear threshold networks. I'm sorry that's jargony, but these are highly abstracted neural network models that, importantly, are mathematically tractable, meaning you can use proofs and so on to conclusively state how different architectures of the model lead to different dynamic features of the activity that the model will produce. You can look at a structure and know what dynamics will result. An age-old challenge in neuroscience, and now deep learning, I suppose, is trying to connect function with structure. So it's possible these CLTN networks are a step toward bridging that gap by connecting structure and dynamics. So we talk about topology, these CLTNs, which Karina always likes to stress is work that she's done with Katie Morrison, and wider topics like the differences between different kinds of modeling approaches, the reason why people with physics backgrounds are especially relevant right now in neuroscience, how we can all remember Jenny's phone number, 8675... Okay, I'll stop. Show notes are at braininspired.co/podcast/141. On the website, you can also check out my Neuro AI online course about many of the topics you hear on the podcast, or decide to throw me a few bucks a month through Patreon with various bells and whistles. Both of those options are of immense help to me. Learn more at braininspired.co. Thanks to everyone who supports the podcast. All right, here's Karina. Karina, have you always been interested and enjoyed math?
Math? Yes, I think so. Although if you had asked me when I was younger, like in high school or even when I started college, if I would become a mathematician, I would have said absolutely not, because that's what my father did. And so it wasn't cool. So I was going to be really different and become a physicist. That was my plan.
Right.
Originally.
Yeah. We were just talking about your background in mathematical string theory. Mm-hmm. So which is what you got your PhD in, you were telling me.
Long time ago, yes, in 2005.
And then you had a decision to make, what was the decision? You didn't tell me what the decision to make was.
Yeah, I actually made the decision before I finished my PhD. So about halfway through grad school. So I went to grad school, first of all, completely focused on this idea of becoming a string theorist. So I had been an undergraduate at Harvard in physics, but I had started taking lots of pure math classes at the time. The environment at Harvard was very surreal in a way, because doing pure math was really considered like very cool. And so I got increasingly interested also because I wanted to be a theoretical physicist, it made sense to take as much math as possible. And then I ended up going to grad school in math, but to do mathematical string theory at Duke, and was very, very much committed to it. And then a few years in, I just realized my heart wasn't in it in a very serious way. Like I loved the mathematics, you know, I still loved kind of the fundamental ideas of string theory. Like I do think it's a lovely theory in many ways, and you know, someone should keep pursuing it. But you know, I didn't, it was at that point, it was sort of like, this was in the early 2000s. It felt like to make a significant advance felt out of reach for a variety of reasons. Anyway, so the point is I became dissatisfied, disillusioned, depressed. I don't know what you want to call it. I had a little bit of a like quarter life crisis, I guess, and just kind of didn't feel like this was right for my career. I still wanted to finish the PhD in string theory, which I did in mathematical string theory. So I finished my PhD, but I started looking for what am I going to do next? So I very much took on this attitude. Okay, I'm going to do this for my PhD. I'm going to write a nice thesis. I'm going to publish it. I did all that. But then I'm going to switch fields. And I made the decision that I'm going to switch fields like probably in the middle of my third year.
And then just kept the grit to stick it out.
And then just kept the grit to stick it out. And I also had to figure out what I'm going to switch to. So I needed a little bit of time.
Well, I want to ask about that too, but did you get an I told you so from your mathematician father as soon as, or did you not confide in him that it was like the mathematics?
I kind of kept this all secret. Okay. Yeah, I was kind of looking for something else. I think in my fourth year, the beginning of my fourth year of grad school, I actually sat in like on an economics course because I was like, oh, maybe economics will be interesting. And that was intolerable because at the level of economics that I had, I needed to sit in kind of on an intro undergrad course. But the intro undergrad course like spent the entire lecture, you know, talking about vector calculus or, you know, just very, you know, math that I was teaching as a grad student. And so it was, you know, there wasn't a good level. There was no like, you know how there's like, you know, there's always field X for dummies, right? But there also needs to be field X for people who know a lot of math and don't want the review.
Yeah, but neuroscience is not that field.
No, neuroscience is not that field. But I was just saying why the economics class didn't work for me. So that was just, yeah, in some ways, maybe sitting in on a neuroscience class was much more appealing because there was no math. So I wasn't bored with the math. It was just like, it was all biology.
Oh,
it was all new.
It hurts. It hurts.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, in the undergrad, no, there's a lot of math in neuroscience, actually. I mean, I don't mean to, otherwise I wouldn't be here, but the intro level neuroscience courses at Duke, right? So I sat in on an intro level neuroscience course and loved it. It was totally different. And in a way, it was all new because I had avoided biology since ninth grade in high school.
Stamp collecting.
Right, exactly.
Did you, when you were sitting in that course then with your heavy math and physics background, did you just immediately see an opportunity to enter the field because, oh, these people, they don't know what they're talking about?
No. I mean, that was not my feeling at all. My feeling was like, wow, this is so cool, you know? And I didn't, you know, it was more just like entering a new land, you know, and just seeing, I was like a tourist, right? And I was like, wow, there's all this beautiful structure, all, you know, who doesn't want to know how the brain works? It just seemed very exciting. And I didn't, you know, see much math in it. I mean, I think maybe the Hodgkin-Huxley equations were like mentioned in passing, you know, like
with a hurrah, we did it. Hodgkin-Huxley, we solved the brain. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. But no, because I really didn't know anything about biology. I mean, I was very, very ignorant. And so to me, it was like learning biology for the first time at age 25, mm-hmm. you know, and wow. I recommend it actually, because by the time you're 25, you really appreciate it. It's like, wow, all these cool things. I mean, you've lived long enough that you know you have a brain, right? And it's kind of fun to learn about how it works. But all the things, you know, the ion channels, the synapses, all the various structures, you know, it was blown away. Just simple things, you know, that you might, everybody in neuroscience knows from when they were babies, right? Like it was all new to me. I didn't see necessarily potential for myself in there, but it was just kind of fun. Much more fun than the economics class. But then it just happened that Duke was running like a computational or theoretical neuroscience seminar series. And so I went to some of the seminars, and I distinctly remember Larry Abbott coming down and giving a talk about vision. But he very much brought, you know, like he does in so many of his talks, he very much brings to the forefront his perspective as a physicist. It was such a lovely talk. And it was like, it was the first time I had ever seen anything like that. It was the first time I had seen a physicist, someone who's, you know, obviously a theoretical physicist by background, talking about neuroscience. And that combination made me see it, you know, made me see myself as being able to do this. I kind of started paying more attention. And then this crazy thing happened. There was a kind of a young professor at Rutgers named Ken Harris. He's still around. He's a very prominent neuroscientist in London now at UCL.
Not so young anymore.
Not so young anymore. Neither am I.
Nor am I.
Yeah, none of us are young anymore. But at the time, he had a very successful postdoc in the Buzhaki lab, and he was starting up his own lab at Rutgers, and he was recruiting. He was trying to recruit postdocs and grad students, and he himself had a background in math and physics and had actually started grad school to do string theory.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, it was full circle. Yeah.
Right. And so I think that's why he gave me a chance. But he started spamming math departments, like literally sent email spam to math departments saying, by the way, I'm starting this lab. If you're, you know, if you have strong quantitative skills and are interested in neuroscience, you know, get in touch. You know, at the time I had just gotten married. Actually, my new husband at the time was also kind of having, Vladimir Itzkov was also having a little bit of a crisis. I mean, he was doing differential geometry as a postdoc and had also kind of lost interest in the problems that he was working on. And together we sort of answered the call and wrote to Ken. Anyway, he ended up hiring us both. And he ended up, but you know, the summer before my fifth year of grad school, he had promised me a postdoc position for after I graduated, and I accepted it before I started my last year. And that was wonderful. It was amazing because suddenly I had this really serious opportunity to learn some neuroscience and to do it in a lab that was being run by someone who, you know, understood my background, right? Someone who really mm-hmm. had kind of a similar background himself. Yeah. So I committed to that postdoc, and then I started my fifth year, and I still hadn't told anybody. And, I remember having this conversation with my advisor where he was like, oh, so it looks like you're going to graduate this year. It's time to start thinking about jobs. It was like in September of 2004. And I was like, oh, I already have a job. So that's when it was really weird. I felt like I was confessing to cheating on him or something, you know, with this other field. But yeah, so I told him that I had already gotten a job and that I was going to go to a neuroscience lab. And I think he was very surprised, but ultimately very supportive. Yeah. And then it made it easy because I didn't apply for jobs. I didn't have to go through that stress of going on the job market, finishing grad school, and so on. And so I just focused on writing up my thesis and learning as much neuroscience as I could to get ready for my new postdoc, and, you know, kind of came in to hit the ground running and went from there. So that was a very long version of my decision and how I switch. But
there's a lot to chew on there, but, and we don't have to perseverate on this, you know, very long. First of all, I wonder how many people were affected by Larry Abbott specifically in this kind of regard, because I don't know if you have the same observation or perception, but that it just seems like the physics background world has infiltrated neuroscience over the past 20 years. I don't know. Do you think that that's true? But B, you know, the physics mindset sort of lends itself to a lot of what, at least these days, is studied in computational neuroscience anyway. But then thinking about, I don't know if we want to talk about relative to string theory in particular, but just maybe physics writ large, do you see the complexity of studying something like the brain as also naturally lending itself to the physics kind of background and mindset? Or because string theory, to me, it seems much more like, you know, reductionist individual particles and equations that don't necessarily feed back on each other, which is a very different story relative to something as quote unquote complex, like a complex system like the brain. I'm wondering if, well, I guess just your thoughts on that.
Yeah. So first of all, I think I absolutely think it's true that physicists have had an enormous influence on theoretical neuroscience. And, you know, I would say maybe half of the theoretical neuroscience community is people with physics backgrounds, maybe more than half. It's hard to tell.
Part of that is because neuroscience was not its own, you know, there weren't neuroscience departments, you know, in so many universities back 20 years ago, right?
Right.
So everyone had to come from somewhere.
Right. Everyone had to come from somewhere. And so I think on some level, neuroscience itself is a little bit like a land of immigrants. You know, I think people in neuroscience come from all kinds of backgrounds, whether it's physics or math or computer science or engineering, or on the other end, psychology, you know, sometimes philosophy, sometimes molecular biology. So I think there's a huge spread of backgrounds in neuroscience, period. You know, just thinking about the more theoretical or mathy end. On the other hand, I think, you know, you might say, well, why are so many physicists? There are other quantitative fields, right? And there's math.
Like why economics.
Are there more, and economics, right? Why are there more physicists than there are mathematicians or economists? And I think what's special about the physics training, it is really a scientific training, fundamentally. I mean, physics is a science. It does deal with, you know, the real world and trying to understand rules for how the world works. But it's also, of all the sciences, I think it's safe to say it's the most mathematically sophisticated. And so every physics student learns a lot of math. Every physics student, you know, no matter what kind of physics they're doing, there's just a huge amount of mathematics that's in the training. And so physics students end up learning a lot of science integrated together with mathematics. So it's like naturally integrated. And I think that's the preparation that is so useful for something like computational neuroscience. It's not, you know, so much the physics content per se or the math content per se, but it's somehow the that integrated approach. It's like physics is just naturally this field that is developed in a way that there's this integrated approach to science and mathematics, where every time there's a physical phenomena you want to understand, first thing you do is start trying to write down some equations. And this is sort of the beautiful thing about it, right? So there's natural phenomena in the world, there are equations you can write down, and this includes complex systems. That idea, right, that you can take some messy, you know, real world situation, maybe idealize it a little bit or a lot, and then write down some mathematical equations. And then you're going to do some math and you're going to analyze those equations, maybe even see how the behavior depends on various parameters in the equations, you know, push and explore scenarios that are not exactly like the one that you're initially trying to describe, but you're looking now at a family of problems. That whole game, right, where you take something about the messy real world, turn it into equations, play with the equations, you know, study them, really understand them, and then feed back into some insight about what's happening with the original physical phenomena. I think that's the training that a physicist gets that is extremely useful. The other thing that helps is that the physics job market sucks if you want to be an actual physicist. That wasn't really the job market that I was a part of. I was sort of more on a math track, which is a little better, actually.
Wow.
But that combination, I think, of very good training to go elsewhere, but like a very bad market to stay in, you know, precisely physics, I think has led to this proliferation. It's almost like, you know, just to use these analogies, right, of land of immigrants, it's almost like physics is like the Soviet Union, right? It was like very good, well-trained people, but like no jobs for them. And neuroscience is like America, like just welcoming, you know, people from all backgrounds. And anyway, I don't want to say much more.
No.
Maybe this is not the moment. Yeah. This is not the moment to make that kind of analogy. But anyway, I think there's something to that.
So the word beauty is often invoked by physicists and by mathematicians. And in 2013, you wrote, it's a very short piece, and I'll read the title. A major obstacle impeding progress in brain science is the lack of beautiful models. And after our brief conversation here, I realize someone of your background who went into, let's say, economics or something like that, might just replace the phrase brain science with whatever field they go into, right? I guess you've kind of covered this already a little bit, but maybe you can restate. You know, that was 2013. Has that changed, or has your thought about that statement and the very brief piece, which I recommend and I'll link to it, has it evolved? Has your thinking about it evolved? Do you think it's changed in neuroscience? And then I just want to talk about what an ugly model is and what a beautiful model is.
Sure. So let me just tell you the context of that piece. So this was in the context of the Obama Brain Initiative. So back in like 2012 or whatever, there was this developing, it hadn't really started yet, this brain initiative was put forward by the Obama administration. It was being led by Terence Sinowski and others. They had a workshop, just like an early workshop, where they kind of gathered people from different corners of neuroscience to discuss what we were going to do in this brain initiative. And so at the time I was, you know, kind of a young assistant professor but had already had a little bit of work that I'd already done in computational neuroscience or theoretical neuroscience. And so, you know, along with just like a handful of other, mathematicians, I was invited to be a part of this, but it was really a big group of people. It was, you know, maybe over 100 people. And all of the participants were asked to write a 1-page white paper with that question. Like, what do you think is the biggest obstacle, advancing progress? Right. So everyone wrote a 1-page paper. So I just wrote that in one day, I like had to submit it. And I just thought, well, you know, I'm going to take a very mathy perspective here. And this is what I think is something to pay attention to. I kind of knew nobody else would highlight the same thing. So that's where it came from. And what I meant by beautiful models really was this idea that I was sort of describing from physics before, is models that you can, you know, that are abstractions in some sense, or are dealing with a simplified version of the real life situation, of the real life phenomenon, but are kind of simple enough that you can analyze them mathematically and get some traction out of that. But rich enough that they really do capture something fundamental about the phenomenon, so that when you do some some mathematical analysis, you actually can gain some insight into the original scientific phenomenon. So, you know, the examples kind of that I had in my head and that I referred to in that white paper were things like the Hopfield model, which for neuroscience was, you know, in the 80s, kind of led to a bunch of physicists getting involved in the field and trying to see if they could study recurrent networks and brain dynamics and so on, using this kind of simple model. And the advantage of it is really that you can do some math, right? So it's like, it's not so simple that any mathematical result is obvious, right? So the idea is that you do have some richness to the model. And so if you analyze it mathematically, you might discover something new that wasn't obvious. It wasn't, you know, an ingredient that you put in by hand. And, but somehow it's a property that emerges from, the properties that you do put in by hand. And so that, you know, as a way of really trying to understand how various scientific properties or scientific phenomena interact and how some depend on others and so on. I think it's a very fruitful game. I think, you know, physics has shown us that doing mathematical analyses on simple models is a very, very fruitful game. And I strongly felt and continue to believe that it's a fruitful game to play in neuroscience as well. But neuroscience is developing in a little bit in a different era. So unlike, you know, most of theoretical physics, neuroscience is developing in an age when we have, you know, powerful computers. And so there's this other pathway as well that you can take with modeling. Whereas that now, you know.
Is this the ugly pathway?
Well, ugly is a little bit of a. I want to be careful.
Well, ugly in the mathematical sense, not in the real world sense, right? So, or, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, in computational neuroscience, the first kind of models, right? Well, not the first kind of models, but they're sort of like these toy models that are kind of simplistic, right? And I don't know that you necessarily need to even do mathematical analyses and prove theorems about them, but then you can simulate them and get results. And then you can kind of build up and, you know, there's that whole simulation streak. But then now there's all these deep learning models. So that's really what I wanted to ask you about are these large deep learning models, transformers, large language models, convolutional neural networks, even like, you know, with recurrence, are those ugly models in the technical sense?
So I wasn't thinking about, yeah, no, I know. I mean, so by the way, I mean, beautiful and ugly are obviously subjective terms, and I meant to use them as subjective terms as well. You know, those were words chosen because they aren't particularly objective, you know, and I didn't want to sort of overplay my opinion here. But what I was thinking of when I wrote that in 2013 was not so much deep learning, which was not as sensational at the time. You know, it's hard to believe, but 10 years ago, it was really not as prominent. And what, you know, I was more thinking about very biophysically detailed models. So, there's another sort of realm of modeling. And this is actually kind of, was, you know, seen like in the Blue Brain Project in Europe. And it's kind of what spurred the Obama Brain Initiative, was sort of a reaction to a huge investment in that kind of project.
That failure.
Well, it hadn't failed yet, right? But, I think there was an idea to have an American response, right? And to do a big, you know, brain investment ourselves, but with a different flavor, very different flavor. And I'm happy for that, actually, for how it played out. I think it played out much better. But anyway, so at the time, that was kind of the other extreme. So it wasn't so much deep learning, which deep learning is also an abstraction. It's also in some sense a very, well, we can talk about that later, but it's not biophysically detailed deep learning networks. I was thinking more about the models where it's like you take a bunch of Hodgkin-Huxley neurons, except you add all these dendrites and all these different compartments. So these multi-compartment models for single neurons, for a single neuron may already have 50 or 100 parameters. And then you put many of them together into this large-scale network. And what happens in a model like that is that in some sense, you have parameters that are interpretable. You can say, oh, this G sub I is the value of a conductance of this particular ion channel on this particular neuron, you know, so you have all these different parameters, you know, and you can put together lots and lots of neurons in a network and add different kinds of inhibitory cells. And so there's a lot of richness that you can build in. I would say it's built in with a lot of guesswork. Because
right, ranges of values, parameter
ranges
values,
of and, values, yeah. and it's the kind of thing that 100 years ago nobody would have done because it would have been impossible
computationally.
Right, you couldn't run a simulation, and that's the only thing you can do with a model like that is run a simulation, right? Yeah. And so, you know, it's not a bad thing that we can run simulations. I do simulations all the time. I think they're very important. They're a very important tool. But in some sense, because we have this extraordinary ability to simulate large sets of differential equations on computer, we have this other choice in modeling, right? We have this other choice in how to develop computational theories that wasn't available when physics was being developed, you know, or when sort of like theoretical physics was really cementing itself and establishing itself as a field. They didn't have this. I actually have brought up the thought, I've come up with this thought experiment before where I was like, what would have happened if back in the beginning of the 20th century, right, before it was even clearly established that atoms existed, right? Way back then when people were sort of laying the foundations for things like statistical mechanics, what would have happened if we had had the ability to measure individual atoms in a gas and track them with position and velocity over time? And, you know, and have this huge database where it's like, okay, here's my gas and here's like 100 million atoms. And, you know, here I'm like, I'm tracking all their positions and velocities over time and seeing how they interact. And now let me build like this giant deep learning model or a, you know, detailed biophysical model, physical model, not biophysical, right, physical right. model.
Unless the atoms have females.
Right. Right? Like, imagine that we could have done that we could have had like gasomics, you know, and just done this like large scale, like gas modeling. Would that have really been better than the way thermodynamics and statistical mechanics developed? You know, obviously it's a different problem. And somehow physicists got lucky that they were able to get so much mileage out of simple mathematical models. But I do think that that sort of not having that ability to do the large scale computational modeling allowed a very different style of modeling to develop.
Oh, now you're calling deep learning practitioners lazy. I see.
No,
I see how it is.
No. I'm saying no, I'm the opposite, right? Like in some sense it's like that's the hard work, right? And it's like I think physicists were forced to take shortcuts and, you know, dramatically reduce dimension and
idealize abstract
and idealize yeah. and abstract. I think they were for it. What I'm saying is for them, it wasn't a choice, right? They were forced to package things in ways that then they could sort of do mathematical computations with pen and paper because that was the tool that they had. They didn't have, you know, supercomputers that could run huge simulations. And so I think that, yeah, there wasn't really a choice there. Now we have a choice. And so, and as with most science, I think when there are choices of different ways to do things, you know, I'm happy for all the choices to be, you know, like there's a community, right? So different people can make different choices and we can explore problems in different ways. I mean, I'm not against those choices, you know, but I think that there's a danger of going too far in the direction of like the large scale computational modeling and then forgetting that there's also a lot of mileage that potentially could be had by, you know, simpler models that can be analyzed mathematically. And that's what the sort of the beautiful models concept that I kind of wanted to promote at the time. And still, you know, I still think that that's, you know, it's just a different pathway of trying to do theory. And I think that it can coexist alongside the other ones. And, you know, I just don't want that one to be forgotten. And that's the one that I, you know, that I feel like I can do well. And, you know, and many people with physics and math backgrounds can do. And I was hoping, you know, with the Brain Initiative, that the Brain Initiative would carve a space for that. That was kind of my hope. And I think it has, actually. So, and I think there are a lot of people who are continuing. I mean, a lot of people with physics training, especially because that's what they're trained to do, who are continuing to do that. And in addition to the large scale modeling. And so I think sometimes the same person is doing both. Right. So, and that's
interdisciplinary.
Yeah. So it's interdisciplinary. Exactly.
My summary of what we just talked about is, you got the beautiful model community, which you're a part of, the ugly model community, and the lazy model community. That's my take home. Is that no? I know.
Yeah, I don't want to be on record calling anyone the ugly model community or the lazy.
And then
model
there's the
community.
Russians and the United States. Yeah, we don't have to.
No, I'm really getting myself in trouble here. No, No, I think there are different approaches. Yeah. So deep learning is another approach that has emerged after, that has emerged as being very prominent in neuroscience, I think, after I wrote that. Yeah, that's kind of going in a different direction, because on the one hand, they are also very abstract models. Deep learning networks are very simple. It's really just like composition of simple functions is what a deep network is doing. But it has a lot of parameters. So it's kind of the simple model in terms of the framework, but really complex in terms of parameters. And so, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it's beautiful or ugly.
Yeah, we can drop that. I just wanted to give you a little bit about it. So we'll kind of come back to that maybe when we talk about the combinatorial linear threshold models, which is part of what you're working on. But before we get there, though, another line of mathematical analysis that applies or is beginning to apply more to neuroscience is topology. But the way that I have been talking about, like your math and physics background, right? It's not as if math and physics freezes. And we figured all math out and we figured all the physics out, and now we can just start applying them because they're both developing also.
And I know that topology is a developing mathematical field as we speak still, right? But you have argued that it's useful as an application to neuroscience as well. So what is topology? And it might be useful to just relate it to the dynamical systems theory, compare, contrast, essentially, since that's another very popular theoretical approach to the geometry of thought and neural activity, et cetera.
Yeah. So, topology is basically geometry without distances. So where you're really thinking more about relationships and what properties of an object are preserved as you can deform it without, just to go back into the cliches, without tearing holes into it, and so on. Yes, as a field, topology is still developing. There's a topology community in mathematics, but I would say that it's sort of developing in two different ways. So there's a traditional topology community. There's low dimensional topology, that people do. If you heard about the Poincaré conjecture being proven, I think 15 years ago now, that was a topology result. So there's definitely, there are a lot of open questions. There's a lot of active work in topology in math. So that's sort of pure topology, but there's also an applied topology community that has emerged recently. So applied topology is kind of a spin-off branch of topology that deals with applications, but in particular, it's really kind of computational topology in a sense. So it deals with finding ways to compute topological properties of data sets, of point cloud data, for instance, but also can be applied to neuroscience data. And so, strictly speaking, the topological ideas that are in applied topology or in this sort of newer computational topology area are 100 years old. The basic questions, you want to look at features of geometric objects that are kind of independent of precise distances. So if you imagine a torus, probably know what a torus is. It's like a bagel, but hollow. And so you have, you can loop string around two different holes that can't be pulled shut. So algebraic topology is a field that has techniques to compute these properties, right? So you can assign to various geometric spaces properties such as these sort of numbers of holes in different dimensions. It's like a sphere, right? It has a two-dimensional hole that it bounds, which is different from kind of a disk with a puncture inside, which would have kind of a one-dimensional hole that it bounds. And so there are these topological invariants that have been defined, like I said, 100 years ago to quantify these sort of qualitative features in a way, sort of looking at qualitative features of geometric objects, but quantifying them. So you can count the number of holes or you can count, what are called Betty numbers and so on. But when it comes, so you know, these are old ideas. They've been used in string theory, by the way. So string theorists definitely, the Calabi-Yau spaces, which I studied as a PhD student, are definitely studied topologically as well. So, you know, topology has been used in other areas of physics already. It's, you know, in some sense, applied topology isn't new, but computational topology, I would say, is relatively new. And so the big breakthrough that was made, you know, starting, I don't know, around 20, 25 years ago is when this field kind of started, and it's really taken off in the last 10 or 15 years, was to develop, you know, with solid mathematical foundations, algorithms that would compute these topological properties for geometric objects that were defined via data, right? So if you have a bunch of points, and now, like, you no longer have kind of this clean mathematical description, say, of the torus, but you've sampled a bunch of points, and maybe they're in this high dimensional space, and you want to know, oh, does that data set have the form of a torus? How would you figure that out? I mean, on some level, it is just a bunch of points. So literally speaking, the topology of the data set is pretty trivial. It's just a bunch of points. But if you think that, oh, these points are sampled from some underlying manifold, and that manifold has a shape to it and has topological features, can you in some way use that data set to estimate or to get a handle on what those topological features are? And the answer is yes, you can. And you can do it by using kind of really basic techniques in algebraic topology, but automating it, you know,
with the
automating these computations. Yes, right. And so that was the big breakthrough, is to sort of the old ideas, but with a new perspective, applying them to data sets, discrete data sets, right? And then developing algorithms to automate them and proving theorems that tell us that the approximations that we make in these algorithms are actually reasonable and will give us the right answer, right? So there are different things, there are different ways in which we have to kind of cheat when we implement these algorithms. And one of the important things that needed mathematical justification was that in some, you know, in some limit, you really are approximating the right answer. And so those foundations were laid down, you know, and still being worked on in various variations, but the basic ones were laid down by a bunch of topologists who started working on this. So people who really were coming from that pure topology community and decided to start working on applied topology. I think they had DARPA support early on. There were some early applications to robotics that excited various government agencies. And now it's completely taken off and is infiltrated in many different communities, including neuroscience.
How so in neuroscience? What is it? How does topology apply to brain data, et cetera?
So, I mean, I think in neuroscience, it is still much more at the beginning. But on one level, so I wrote an article about this maybe back in 2017, which is what can topology tell us about the neural code? So high level, I mean, on some level, and this is one of the things I articulated in that article, you know, neuroscience produces lots of data, right? So just in the sense that topological data analysis is another lens for analyzing data, for trying to do dimensional reduction, for looking at features of data sets and so on, you know, that there's kind of an obvious hope that it might be applicable, just by the nature of having large scale data. But there are, I think, even more compelling reasons to look for topology, which is that I think that there's some evidence, right, that there are areas of the brain that are really encoding topological features of stimuli as opposed to being so focused on the metric properties. And so one of the places where, you know, sort of the early places where we found that there was a really natural application of ideas from topology was looking at something like hippocampal place cells and place fields. So I'm just thinking about really the classic setup where you have, you know, a rat roaming around some open field environment, recording place cells in CA1 or CA3 of the hippocampus. And you know, you have these individual neurons that appear to be acting as sensors for localized regions of the environment. So, you know, you can think of the place fields are like these oval-like regions, hotspots, where when the animal crosses through one of those regions, the neuron associated to that region starts firing a lot. But these regions are overlapping. So you have, you know, many neurons, right? And every neuron has its own place field. And you can think of, you know, people typically think of the place fields as covering the entire environment that the animal is in.
And thus we have a cognitive map to navigate an environment.
Like a cognitive map, right? But interestingly, right, the cognitive map, if you think about the activity, the neural activity itself, it doesn't necessarily encode the map itself, right? So you have this, how do I say this? The place field is something the experimentalist computes, right? So you do it by correlating positions to the firing of this neuron. And so if you know all the positions that the animal went through and you know who fired at every position, you can construct the place fields. But within the brain itself, sort of like the only information really is the spiking of the neurons. And the place maps, the cognitive map is not a topographic map. You know, the same cells can either overlap or not in different environments. Yeah. It's not like retinotopy in the visual cortex. It's very different. And so in some sense, if you think about what information is really available to the brain, it's not the position information necessarily, because there's no sensor for position, but somehow it's the information about when place fields overlap. So if two cells fire at the same time or in a small time window, you can infer that their place fields overlap because there must be some position that's activating both neurons. Mm-hmm. And so if you look at the co-firing, if you look at the neural code that emerges from the animal roaming around this environment, it gives you information about which place fields overlap, but not where they are. So you don't know, you know, if I'm just looking at the spike trains, if I'm just looking at the spiking, I can say, all right, the place field from neuron 1 overlaps with the place field with the place fields from neurons 5, 7, and 15. Also, 5 and 15 overlap, and there's a three-way overlap between 1, 5, and 15. I mean, you can say things like that, but you don't necessarily know where the place fields are located. And so one of the questions back in like 2007 that Vladimir and I asked, actually, so we were at the time, we were sort of talking and collaborating with the Buzhaki lab, and so thinking a lot about place cells and so on. One of the questions we asked is like, well, what can you learn about the environment? What can you learn about the stimulus space just from that information, just from knowing which place fields overlap without knowing where the place fields actually are? And it turns out that you can learn quite a bit about the topology of the environment. You can learn if there are holes in the environment. Like if the rat is roaming on a table that has a hole cut out of it, or maybe a tree in the middle, some place that it can't traverse. Mm. And you can do that using methods from algebraic topology, because in fact, algebraic topology allows you to infer topological properties of a space from what's called an open cover. So an open cover would be like a bunch of open sets that cover a space. Now you can imagine, you know, going back to my torus or a sphere or some other topological space. If you take a bunch of open sets that cover it, and that cover is good in some sense that I'm not going to, technical sense that I'm not going to describe. But if you have a bunch of sets like that, which you can think of like place fields, right? Covering your topological space, and you know how they overlap. So you can encode the information of how they overlap in a combinatorial structure called the nerve of the cover. They actually called it the nerve of the cover, yeah. Like 100 years ago. No connection to neuroscience. But you can encode that in this combinatorial object called the nerve of the cover, which is a simplicial complex, which is, it's a generalization of graphs. So graphs, you know, have edges between pairs of objects. This is like a graph, but instead of just having edges between pairs, you can also have like a triangle between a triple or a tetrahedron between a quadruple and so on. And that's keeping track of the overlap. So if I have place fields, you know, 1, 5, and 15, and they not only pairwise overlap, but there's also a triple overlap, then instead of having a graph where I just connect 1, 5, 5, 15, and 15 and 1, I also fill in this triangle to denote that there's a triple overlap as well. And so that overlap information, you know, in topology land gives us this nerve of the cover, the simplicial complex that encodes all of that intersection data. And there's a theorem called the nerve lemma, or the nerve theorem, depending on which version. And that mathematical result tells you that you can compute these topological features, like homology groups, which count these holes that I was talking about earlier. You can compute them from the nerve, from that combinatorial object of the cover, and it will tell you what those same topological features are of the underlying space that's covered by those open sets. So this is exactly like the place field setup, right? So the place fields are like the open sets. The animal's environment is like the underlying topological space. And what this theorem, you know, 100-year-old theorem from algebraic topology is telling us is that just from that combinatorial data of who intersects with who, even without knowing who the place fields are, right? Who the open sets are, just knowing how they overlap, you can compute topological features of that underlying space that was covered. So this is like kind of a magical,
No, I was going to say, which map onto in the case that we're talking about, the example, which map onto the environment essentially with holes and borders and so on.
Exactly. Which map onto the environment. Exactly. And so in the neuroscience context, you know, what this translates to is the neural code intrinsically encodes topological properties of the environment in the case of, say, hippocampal place cells. And so that, I think, is a really lovely insight, right? And so that neural codes, when you look at the structure of the entire code, it's not just about, you know, which pattern of firing corresponds to which stimulus, but somehow the collection of all the firing patterns, the collection of all the code words has structure in it. And that structure of the code reflects structure of the stimulus space that's being encoded.
We can't record all neurons, right? In, let's say, hippocampus, CA1 or something, right? So you're only subsampling. So does that affect the ability of a topological analysis to, you know, complete the cognitive map?
Yeah, absolutely. So you know, Vladimir and I wrote a paper on this back in 2008 where we simulated place cells from place fields, you know, using sort of properties of place fields that were taken from real data, but, you know, making many of them, right? So that we completely cover the space as a proof of principle that this would actually work. And so that, you know, again, because of limitations of data, right, we had to kind of make synthetic data that matched in terms of properties with real data, but was nevertheless, you know, complete, right? So you can completely cover the space.
Yeah.
However, I should say a lot of advances have been made by now. And so I think the most recent result, really looking at these topological properties in neuroscience, is coming from the Moser lab. So they have this Nature paper that was published just last year. I forget the name, toroidal structure or something of in grid cells. So they actually were able to record lots and lots of cells, enough to really cover the space. But they, in their case, they're doing grid cells, and grid cells are interesting because there you have this repeating grid-like structure. So the grid cells are kind of like place cells in that they are responding to, you know, positions in space, except that a single neuron will have many hotspots that it responds to, and they form a hexagonal grid. And so different neurons will have different hexagonal grids that they're associated to that are kind of shifted from each other.
In scale and orientation, yeah.
Yes, in scale and orientation. And they really can be grouped into these modules because If you have a different scale to your grid, you want to sort of group all those neurons together that have different phases and different orientations, but are sort of on the same grid size. And so they were able to record so many neurons that they could capture enough grid cells to cover the space with various modules, if that makes any sense. And there, because of the sort of hexagonal structure of the grid cells, of the grid cell map, it was predicted from topology considerations that those neurons should trace out a torus. That paper is really a tour de force in terms of recording enough neurons that they can actually see that torus. They can see the topological structure of the torus in the neural activity. And again, it just points to topology being fundamental to neural coding. And I think that we're going to see that in more and more areas, more and more systems. And I think that's sort of an exciting reason to use topology in neuroscience that goes beyond just, oh, it's data, let's analyze it with topology because we can. You know, I think there's something more fundamental than that when it comes to neural coding in particular, that oftentimes what's being encoded really is topological in nature.
So the structure of like a topological structure, well, what I want to ask is sort of really high level, how topology relates to the dynamical systems theory, because there's a lot of neuroscience talking about manifolds, reducing dimension, and there are trajectories along these low dimensional manifolds. And that's how we can sort of describe, in a way, some cognitive function as having some manifold shape. And so anyway, it sounds like topology and dynamical systems theory are highly overlapping, but how do they differ? What's different between the two?
Yeah, so that is a good point. I mean, even in the math community, there is a long tradition of dynamical systems and topology overlapping, I should say. And so that is not just a phenomenon in neuroscience. That is something that goes way back. And that is because dynamical systems, when you look at the configuration spaces for them, when you look at sort of the set of all the states that the system can have or the attractors of the system and so on, those can be often described by manifolds that have certain topology. And so understanding topology has always been fundamental to understanding dynamical systems. And I think in neuroscience, it's a similar connection. So, and this is another way that topology can potentially play a big role in neuroscience is an understanding those lower dimensional manifolds. So, when people talk about sort of dynamic attractors, or they talk about manifolds of activity, in some sense, they're really thinking about attractors, right? So they're thinking of a dynamical system. The network is kind of this giant dynamical system, but the activity, the population vectors or what have you, whatever you're tracking of the activity, are getting sucked into a lower dimensional space and not sampling the full repertoire of possible states that you might think you have. And those lower dimensional structures, sometimes it might be appropriate to call them attractors of the network. But even if not, you know, you would want to describe them topologically. You would want to know, okay, is that like a periodic structure? Is it a torus? Is it a loop that comes back to itself? There are all kinds of, you know, questions that you could ask about the shape of that. And that would sort of get to the heart of what the network is doing. So somehow you have this complicated dynamical system, which is your neural network, but the emergent activity of that network would sort of get like trapped or sucked into this lower dimensional manifold that itself, if you tried to describe it, would have some topological properties. And so that topology of that manifold is somehow a property of the network and of the way that the network functions.
Okay. All right. We got to, I really want to cover the linear network. So I'm just going to skip ahead a little bit to those. So, beautiful models, combinatorial linear threshold networks. this is what I originally wanted to talk to you about also. And then, of course, I did a deep dive and then all the other questions come out. But these are interesting in that I think that they apply to your beautiful model camp, because they are even more abstracted. Maybe I'll just try to describe them and then you can correct me and then we can talk about what they do and stuff. So first of all, sure. One of the goals is to be able to look at the structure of a network and then predict the dynamics that if you ran that network, predict the dynamics that it would give rise to, different attractors, et cetera. I know that's one of the goals. So, I mean, that's an interesting thing because there's this structure function problem in neuroscience, right? With Eve Marder's work, for example, if you look at structure, lots of different structures can give rise to the same function depending on your parameters that you're using. Some, you know, you can call it multiple realizability. But it's also, you know, daunting to, the thought is that we may never be able to look at a structure and know function. But if we can look at a structure and know some dynamical properties, that might lend something to say about the function. Anyway, I'm rambling, but what you've essentially done, and maybe we can talk about like the simplest, you know, smallest ones, and we don't need to go through examples, but you've gone down to like even two nodes, three nodes, four nodes, and abstracted away into this graphical network where the nodes can be connected, and the nodes are all excitatory neurons. And when one node points to the other, it's going to excite that neuron. Meanwhile, in the background, you have this invisible, writ large inhibitory activity that is affecting the whole network, but with kind of different rules for how it affects different nodes, depending on which nodes are pointing to which other nodes and connected in certain ways. And that sounds, you know, very complicated, but it's actually a stripped down and very simple way, which makes it tractable mathematically, correct?
Yeah, that's a great description, actually. Yes.
Oh, good. Okay. So, mm-hmm. And I know this is kind of related. This goes back to the idea of Hopfield networks, because these are, you know, recurrent networks, because there's loops and loops and loops, depending on how big you build it up. And Hopfield networks are kind of a special case of this, because they have like symmetric connections between all the units and et cetera. So with that kind of background description in mind, what have we learned about, you know, how structure, you know, how far can we get looking at a structure? So you've done this from, you know, two nodes together up to, I don't even know how big you have gotten so far, but where you've been able to prove that if you set a node up this way, or if you can look at all the connections, if there are different sinks and sources and the way that different nodes are connected, without even fooling with weight connection parameters, you've been able to prove what kind of dynamics can emerge from that structure.
Yeah, we've been able, I mean, not completely, but we've been able to say a lot. And it's been exciting. So the basic results that we have are kind of, I think you mentioned graph rules. So what are these? These are direct relationships between graph structure and fixed point structure. So I should say the way we have access to the dynamics of these networks is, primarily through the fixed point structure. You know, familiar to anyone who's studied Hopfield networks or has studied, you know, any kind of networks in neuroscience, is the idea of stable fixed points. So, when your activity goes to, you know, a single firing rate vector that kind of persists, persistent activity is often modeled by a stable fixed point. And in the Hopfield model, the memory patterns are all modeled by stable fixed points of the dynamics. So these are really a single point in your state space. So I have a pattern of firing and I'm just stuck there. But there are many of those patterns that I can get stuck in. So if you imagine kind of this landscape and there are these minima of your landscape, and what the computation of the network is to take an initial condition, evolve the network dynamics until you fall into one of these minima, and that's your recovered pattern. And so that initial condition could be a partial pattern of, you know, maybe an image that has missing pixels and has like a partial pattern. And then the network would evolve it to do pattern completion to fill out the rest of the pixel values.
So if I had a degraded picture of a mouse face or something, I would easily, right, because of that pattern completion, my Hopfield network inside my brain would settle down to the mouse pattern and I would be able to say, oh, mouse.
Exactly. Yeah. So that corrupted pattern would put you in a, in an initial condition that is in what's called the basin of attraction of the complete pattern, which is stored already in the network. And if you don't have that pattern stored already in the network, you won't complete it. So you can only kind of complete patterns that have been previously stored in the network. And so you imagine the entire state space, right? All the possible firing rate vectors, gets partitioned into these basins of attraction, which is like the region where if I start there, I'm going to get sucked into a particular attractor. And the attractors here are all just stable fixed points, and they correspond to sort of a single pattern that's been stored, or a code word. You might say the neural code of the network is like all those stored patterns. And so the Hopfield model was really about that setup, right? And so the questions that were asked were, how do I store patterns in the network? What kind of learning rule? Once I have all these stored patterns, am I going to get extra spurious patterns that I didn't mean to store, right? Because sometimes it's like, it's not clear that I can just arbitrarily choose pattern A, B, and C without accidentally creating a new pattern that I didn't want to create. And if I create too many patterns, then my basins of attraction get too small and too finicky. And so then I can't really complete, you know, I might start with that corrupted mouse picture, but because I have so many different patterns stored, maybe I will accidentally go into the wrong attractor. And so those are, there are issues of capacity. How many patterns can you reliably store without, you know, and still recover them with reasonable initial conditions and so on. And so that's this, this whole game of how memory works, right? So this is kind of a framework for thinking about memory as consisting of these stored patterns that are really encoded in the synaptic weights of the network. And in the case of the Hopfield model, they really are all kind of stable fixed points. And the model itself, in order to guarantee that, has symmetric weights. So that just means that between any two neurons, the connection from neuron I to neuron J is identical to the connection from J to I. So that is, you know, not true in the real brain.
Despite processing. Well, yeah, no, not true. Not true.
Right. Not true.
Brain's messier. But your models, but your models are super abstracted and not messy either, right? So sorry to interrupt, but.
Yeah. So it's not true. The brain is messier, but like this particular messiness can be done, you know, by simply not having symmetric weights anymore. But the, and so, in the combinatorial threshold linear network models, we don't require symmetry, right? So we don't require the connections to be symmetric. And that just means we allow that sort of W matrix of connection strengths to have a different IJ value from its JI value. That opens up the dynamics into a whole richer world of possibilities. So it turns out when you impose the symmetry, there are some other conditions that I'm sort of going to gloss over, but roughly speaking, when you impose the symmetry on these weight matrices, you can get multiple stable fixed points, which is a feature of nonlinear dynamics. So you get nonlinear phenomena, the multistability, but you can't get dynamic attractors. So you're still stuck with only having stable fixed points as your possible attractors.
Why do we want to get dynamic attractors, though?
Because the memories, that's a great question, right? Why do we want to? So, you know, if all you care about is taking corrupted images and pattern completing, you don't care about dynamic attractors, right? And if that's all your brain wants to do is look at a fragmented picture and say, oh, that's a dog, you know, or that's a cat, then you don't really need dynamic attractors. But I would argue that, well, first of all, when we look at brain activity, it does not appear to go into fixed points. It's always oscillating. It's always constantly changing. And one of the things that I think the, you know, neural recordings show us, which is why the sort of manifold methods and so on are so popular these days, is that often what happens to the neurons in a network in response to a stimulus is they don't go to a stable fixed point, but they do get sucked into some lower dimensional manifold, or what I might call an attractor, that is dynamic. So you might have a, you know, stimulus comes in, you have some big transient response potentially from the network. I used to work in auditory cortex when I was a postdoc. So it's like we would see, you know, we'd have a sound played, We were recording from primary auditory cortex in rats. We'd see some big transient response, lots of neurons firing. And then the activity would like settle down and there would be some subset of neurons that would continue to fire a lot, but not in a stable fixed point kind of way. There would still be some kind of oscillation, some sort of dynamic activity, but in this lower dimensional space. So it'd be kind of sucked into like a, you know, like an attractor that is dynamic. The other thing I should say is that, you know, beyond seeing this in experiments, it's clear that we're able to store memories that are dynamic, right? So we can remember sequences. We can remember, you know, the alphabet. We can remember songs.
8675309?
8675309. I put that in one of my talks.
Yeah, because you give an example of a network that can encode, if you assign a number to each of the nodes of the network, it spits out this limit cycle, which encodes at the peak of every neuron's firing, every unit's firing it spells out the phone number anyway, which is a famous song by, I don't remember who. But so there are these like dynamic sequences and limit cycles and all these different types of attractors, right, that you can get out of these networks.
Right, exactly. So it's like when I'm remembering a phone number, it seems perfectly reasonable to model that as a limit cycle. Like I'm remembering a sequence and you know, we don't do this anymore, right? Because we have cell phones and we just have we used to like look up phone numbers in the phone book and then have to like remember it until we got to the payphone, you know, to dial it. And I would play it in a loop, right? I would think of the number in a loop and so there's something very dynamic about the way many memories are encoded. I mean, I should also say there's also this whole area of central pattern generator circuits, which I'm very interested in, which has traditionally been modeled with limit cycles in the sort of mathematical and theoretical neuroscience community. Some of Eve Marder's work with theorists, right, has been very specifically about modeling central pattern generator circuits. And there you see limit cycles all the time. You see periodic sequences of neural activity that repeat. Like if you imagine a animal locomotion, right? You have a horse walking or trotting or something, and it's a periodic, a repeating sequence of signals or activity.
Left hoof, right hoof, back hoof, forward hoof. Yeah,
exactly.
You've also demonstrated that's something else. But so then you have these examples that you use in your talks and papers of these kind of different kinds of attractors. But and I'm sorry if I'm skipping ahead too much. I'm just aware of our time. But I'm just wondering, in some sense, these are still small kind of toy models. And the background inhibition that I talked about, there are just two rules, right, of this inhibition that affects all of the units the same way. I'm wondering, you know, can we really apply this to real messy brain data, right? And look at, you know, record neurons and say something about the dynamical structure and prove it mathematically, right, in some structure of the brain. And then B, like, just how far up do you feel like you can scale these models in a tractable way? Because I know that you have like submodules and there are rules for motifs being embedded within larger motifs, and you can still look at that structure and talk about some of the chaotic talk about some of the types of attractors that come out. So is this something that just will scale easily?
So it's true that the examples I show in my talks, which are the sort of like the ones we've studied the most, you know, kind of show off the techniques.
Yeah, which are super cool, by the way.
They tend to be small because we're sort of designing them to. So one of the questions that we like to ask is how do you encode multiple dynamic attractors at once, right? So if you go back to the Hopfield model, right, one of the challenges was like, okay, how do I store multiple memory patterns as fixed points, you know, and keep them all, right, so that you can still recover them and you don't have too much interference. And if you ask that question about dynamic attractors, right, it's trickier because now you're no longer talking about, you know, isolated stable fixed points. Now you have these larger, you know, these dynamic attractors that have, you know, it's a subset of the state space. It's a big loop of activity and you have many of them and they may share the same neurons between them. And And you want to know, like, how is it possible to store those in a larger network in sort of a modular fashion that preserves the dynamic attractor even as you're adding other stuff to the network? And what we have found are rules that allow us to kind of predict when, you know, one of these sort of smaller networks that produces a dynamic attractor, when that dynamic attractor will persist when embedded in a larger network. And sometimes we can predict that will happen, and sometimes it's happening even though we don't have a good handle on why. But there's something about the inhibitory structure that really helps to be able to, like, encode these structures. And so I would say that in order to scale things up, we really do sort of depend on this strong, locally strong inhibition in order to sort of keep the attractors clean. I don't know if that makes any sense, but somehow the inhibition is what allows the attractors to really lock in and stay there even as you make the network larger. And so we've done these experiments, for instance, where we kind of, a big thing that we do is we try to classify motifs that support attractors, right? So one of the questions you might ask, like, okay, I have this large network. What are the substructures that are really supporting these dynamic attractors that you might see? So going back to kind of the experimental data that I was telling you about, where you might have some large transient of activity and then it settles into some subset of neurons that are really firing, but in some kind of pattern that's dynamic. So you might ask, okay, well, there's a subnetwork for those neurons alone. And somehow that subnetwork is supporting this lower dimensional attractor. But it's embedded in the larger network, right? So how does that happen? How can you take a dynamic attractor that is really supported on a small network and still have it persist when you've embedded it in the larger network? And that is definitely something that we think a lot about and have made some progress on. So mathematically, one of the things we can prove theorems about is when kind of the unstable fixed point that's associated to the dynamic attractor, when that one will persist. And that gives us clues as to when the attractor will persist. And so via the fixed point structure and via the way the fixed point structure changes or is preserved when a subnetwork is embedded in a larger network, we get sort of strong clues as to whether those attractors survive. And so that's the sense in which we think about scaling it up. So the perspective is that somehow you have modules, you know, subnetworks in the brain that do things, right? And you want to understand how they can be embedded in a larger network. So let's say they can still do their thing and not be kind of destroyed in terms of the activity they produce by the way that they're embedded. So those are sort of the questions that we have.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Is this something that would, like, potentially solve the binding problem? As you know, you think, like, looking at a horse, or like if you're in front of a horse, right? You see the horse, you smell the horse, you can hear the horse, and it's like a cohesive experience, right? Are these submodules that are in some topological toroidal shape that's somehow, and that's the binding? Voila.
Yeah, I mean, I've thought a little bit about the binding problem because I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, but on one of the cool things that we've found and that we can predict via the fixed point structure is these attractors that we call them fusion attractors. So it's almost like, oh, I have an attractor, some dynamic pattern supported on or a fixed point, you know, supported on one subnetwork. And I have another subnetwork that has another kind of attractor. And if they are embedded, so previously I was saying, okay, there are ways we can embed those subnetworks to preserve the attractor in the larger attractor, right? In the larger network. Sorry, I meant the larger network. And so that's one question, right? How do you embed so that these individual attractors are preserved in the larger network? But there are other ways to embed them where you lose the individual attractors, but you gain an attractor that really looks like a fusion between the two. So it's like they're both going at the same time. And that is really striking because now somehow I've been able to take these different pieces and connect them up in such a way that I still see the individual attractors going. So maybe I have a three cycle going for, you know, some subset of neurons and, you know, a fixed point or some other dynamical attractor going for another subset of neurons, and now I've embedded them together and I've connected them in such a way that in the larger network, what I will see is them turning on together into a single higher dimensional attractor that encodes kind of both attractors at once. And that feels like a binding kind of thing.
And or it, the emergence of consciousness or something. Yeah.
Yeah, no. Not yeah, sure about no. consciousness. And I don't think CTLNs are sentient.
Oh, come on. Why is that getting so much traction? Yeah. But, so I know that I've already taken you over, but maybe the last thing that we can end on is just how how plausible is it given how messy the brain is? And you know, we haven't even mentioned that for just to bring it back to like a deep learning network where the whole thing is about the weights changing and learning, right? Mm-hmm. These networks are so abstracted that you fix the weights. You fix like the parameters, and there's very few parameters, which is what makes them tractable in the first place. But then applying that to real wet brains, is there going to be a clean mapping there?
Yeah. So I should say, so the CTLNs, I do think of them as having fixed weights for a graph, but there are these parameters for the weights, right, that we are allowed to change. And so one of the goals, right, is to the graph rules, for instance, which tell us how to relate fixed points to the structure of the graph, those are parameter independent. So I can change the weights within some what we call a legal range. I can alter the weights and preserve the basic structure of the fixed points. So that's, you know, so we do sort of, we are trying and we often do prove results that are largely independent of those weights. Hmm. That said, you know, even with a two parameter family is still a very small number of parameters for, you know, a network of N neurons. And so we also study more general threshold linear networks. And one of the things that we have found is you often have the same attractor that can appear in different networks. I mean, this is not so surprising given what I've just told you, that we think about how do you embed a particular subnetwork so that the dynamic attractor is preserved, right? But so once you understand the rules for that, then what that tells you is that there are weights that you can change in the larger network that keep the attractor intact. And so that really addresses kind of the learning.
So there's a robustness.
Yeah, there's a robustness. And there's this concept that, you know, once I embed a dynamic attractor, you know, with say some subset of neurons, 5 neurons, 10 neurons, right, in a larger network that maybe has hundreds or thousands of neurons, there are now edges that I want to freeze, right? There are weights that I don't really want to change because I want to preserve my attractor. But there are other edges, there are other weights that are going to be free, and I can freely move them and still keep this attractor. And I have these sort of simulations where I show moving through that weight space. And it's really striking because you see this, you know, different dynamical systems, you know, solutions to different dynamics, and they're just right on top of each other. It's really like the same attractor, but I'm changing edge weights, I'm changing the network, but I'm really preserving this attractor in this piece of it. And so that I think the way that we are, what we want to understand is, you know, who's allowed to be plastic, right? What weights are allowed to change in order to preserve an attractor, and what weights, if we change them, we may actually lose the attractor or distort it. And understanding that is really kind of the key to sort of developing learning rules that would allow you to store multiple attractors in a network, you know, without distorting them. Because now it's no longer an issue. Like in the Hopfield model, the question is how many memory patterns can I store and not lose the previous ones? But here, it's not just about losing the attractor. You can corrupt it because now it's not a point anymore.
Yeah.
Right? It's a whole dynamic attractor and you can really distort it. And so how do you preserve the full dynamic attractor and in this larger network? And so we are studying in the broader TLN space, so not confined to the combinatorial threshold linear networks, which are a subfamily, but in the broader family of threshold linear networks where in principle all the weights are allowed to change freely, we are trying to understand which weights matter and which weights don't matter for particular attractors, and thereby figure out where the plasticity is. And so the vision is that somehow the networks in the brain, once you encode certain attractors, you might want to kind of stabilize certain synapses, but others are left free and can be freely changed to store a different attractor, some other song, some other pattern of activity, and still guarantee that you preserve the first one. Right? So that's how, you know, you and I can learn the same song and not corrupt everything else we know.
But I can learn Jim's phone number too, and Mary's, and
right. Yeah. And I don't have to know those, and somehow
you don't need to know those.
Right.
But I need to make a song out of them to remember them, of course, as we learned with what was her name in that song?
Jenny?
Jenny. I believe it was
Jenny's phone number.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, Karina, I'm glad this is all so easy for you, and I appreciate you talking with me. I promise this is the last question. How much more math are we going to need to learn to, well, quote unquote, understand the brain? You know, do we have the right math tools, or do we need to, you know, how many more different math tools will we need to apply, invent, and or apply?
That's a loaded question. I think we're still very limited in our math tools, honestly. So, and I'll just, you know, quickly say why. Neural networks fundamentally are high-dimensional, nonlinear dynamical systems. And high-dimensional, nonlinear dynamical systems are a nightmare mathematically. It's really hard. And if you see what people do when they analyze networks, I mean, it's striking. And to this day, 2022, you know, people will simulate large nonlinear networks, you know, that do all kinds of crazy things. And then when they come down to analyze them mathematically, they linearize. It's like linearize around a fixed point.
Yeah.
Right. Which, by the way, requires that you have a fixed point to linearize around and a single one that somehow is representative of the activity of the whole network, which, you know, when you think about, you know, that real networks probably have multiple fixed points, multiple attractors, you know, you can't just pick one point in the space to linearize around. And so I think there's a fundamental gap between the tools we have to analyze large dynamical systems, which tend to be just linear algebra linear tools, and the beast, which is high dimensional nonlinear dynamics. And that's a gap that exists in the math world too. It's not that mathematicians secretly have books where they figured out all of this stuff. It's just a real gap. And I think with threshold linear networks, you know, I am trying in my own way to fill that gap in some very simplified, you know, kind of the simplest nonlinearity you can have, but, you know, fully high dimensional systems of differential equations with a very simple nonlinearity, and trying to actually develop mathematical theory that would, you know, allow us to predict. So, you know, when it comes to linear systems, I can give you a giant matrix. If you have a linear system of differential equations, we teach our undergrads how to solve these.
Yeah.
And you can predict long-term behavior. You can predict, you know, if you have a Markov chain, you can predict the long-term behavior, the long-term dynamics. You can answer that question mathematically. You put nonlinearity in there, and now you're screwed. Yeah. But if the nonlinearity is simple enough, like threshold linear, you're not screwed. Not completely, right? And that's kind of what the threshold linear network is trying to do. It's trying to generalize the theory of linear systems of differential equations to a mildly nonlinear. Mildly, but like still dramatic enough that you get, you know, dynamic attractors and all these things that you don't see in linear systems. Linear systems, you have one fixed point, is either stable or it's unstable, and that's the end of the story. But once you put in that threshold for the nonlinearity, now you get the whole repertoire. You get chaos, you get limit cycles, you get multi-stability, you get all of that stuff, but you still somehow can piggyback on the tools of linear differential equations in patches, right? With combinatorics, with care, right? You can kind of bootstrap from there and get access to the nonlinear phenomena. So that's what I'm trying to do. And the reason I'm trying to do it is because I do think it's a real mathematical gap, and there are many. Yeah, I think neuroscience is really a field that is experimentally super advanced, I would say, compared to, you know, 19th century physics, you know, but mathematically, I think there are a lot of challenges, and that's part of why our theory and our modeling is still somewhat limited, because we're still relying on linear methods all the time, and that's really limiting our data analysis and our dynamical systems modeling and just our theory in general. And so, yeah, so unfortunately, well, unfortunately for some people, fortunately for mathematicians like me, I think there's a lot to do.
One person's challenge is another's opportunity. So
exactly. Karina,
thank you for my opportunity to speak with you, and thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Brain Inspired is a production of me and you. I don't do advertisements. You can support the show through Patreon for a trifling amount and get access to the full versions of all the episodes, plus bonus episodes that focus more on the cultural side but still have science. Go to braininspired.co and find the red Patreon button there. To get in touch with me, email paul@braininspired.co. The music you hear is by The New Year. Find them at thenewyear.net. Thank you for your support. See you next time. The stair